We're back with more Inside the Clubhouse with Bruce Levine and David Haugh.
Yeah, no, it's definitely going to be a huge adjustment period for the guys. And there's even times when personally I step off the mound, need a breath.
Right.
I'm really big into breathing, so I'm not the biggest fan of the pitch clock rule. You know what I mean? I don't believe in telling Clayton Kershaw, Max Scherzer that these guys have to throw a pitch in a certain amount of time because there's a whole preparation that people don't understand that goes into delivering a quality pitch.
Welcome back inside the clubhouse, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score, David Haugh, Bruce Levine, until 11 o'clock. That was Marcus Stroman. Like so many pitchers in so many spring training complexes this week, talking about the changes to the game and how it will affect their approach between pitches, between innings, between games. Bruce, the rules changes are going to have an impact on the fan experience as well. Real quickly, there's going to be 15 seconds between pitches if the bases are empty, and 20 if there's a runner on. That's going to change how they approach, and it's going to be something that I think increases the pace of the game. There will be shift restrictions. The defensive team will have a minimum of four players in the infield and at least two infielders completely on either side of second base. That will change the approach. And then finally, bigger bases increasing from 15 inches to 18 on each side, which in theory, they have the evidence to back it up, will be safer and reduce injuries theoretically. But also, it's going to invite base stealers to say, I can get there faster because the base is bigger, and that 4.5 inches is going to make a difference, and I can get to second base. Last year, MLB's base stolen leader was 41 bases. That was the number one base stealer in Major League Baseball. That'll change because of these rule changes, Bruce. I'm excited to see how it does affect the game.
Well, I think if you're taking your last point a little further, the most essential thing will be the fact that the pitcher can only throw over or even step off twice and not be able to throw to first base. So you add the extra 3 inches on the bag, and then you add the fact that you don't have to be the fastest base runner or the best base runner to be able to steal a base, knowing you can take as big a lead as you want, albeit being fearful that the catcher can backpick you and pick you off that way with pitch out. So I think the game is going to change because base stealing won't necessarily be for base stealers anymore. It's for people that can work that advantage into the mix of not throwing over or perceiving that a catcher won't throw over or a pitcher won't throw over, and then having that advantage in your head. So I expect to be a huge difference in stolen bases going forward next year. I believe the emphasis on speed players that are in the minor leagues now is going to resurface, and you're going to see specialists, especially impactful late in games again with this rule that's going to really put an awful lot of pressure on the pitcher and catcher to control the running game late in a ballgame.
Major League Baseball did a tremendous job this week getting out in front of this and selling it in a way that surprised me, because Major League Baseball doesn't do that very often very well. They're not the most PR savvy organization in professional sports, as we have seen, but Theo Epstein was out front and center on the MLB Network on different interviews. He was on the Mullin Haw Show on Friday morning, Bruce, and I think we began our interview talking about just how these rules changes are going to cater to baseball fans.
The standard can't be to make everybody happy, because as a famous American once said, you can't please all the people all the time. So that's not going to happen. But look, these rule changes are designed for the fans. And so I think it will, in the long run, go really well and make for a better version of baseball, a more entertaining product for the fans, and therefore, greater interest in the game and a better industry overall for everybody.
That's what it's all about. The fan experience. People want to know that they're not going to be there for 4.5 hours necessarily, 4 hours. And also just between
seven
pitches.
Seven innings.
Well, I don't think you need to get crazy here, Bruce. I mean, nine innings is still nine innings.
That's not crazy. We're catering to the modern fan.
Well, I mean, look, they can have a little discipline. There's a happy medium to find here. The best thing that he said about that is that it's like it will be like Mark Burley pitching for both teams.
Yeah, no, I understand. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. Again, we're catering to the viewer, listener, fan, or quasi-fan who's between, what would you say, 18 and 45, right? That's who baseball wants to market to right now, because they understand that the average age in baseball of watching all their top events mostly has been in the 53, 54-year-old average age. That's scary because there's a 10-year gap that's missing there that Major League Baseball is fearful of, and that's why we've seen some dwindling attendance and some a little bit of erosion as far as the watching audience goes. So from that perspective, David, I think that we're catering to a certain element of baseball. I think the older fans are content with the game. They've been watching it for their whole lives, and they'll sit through three-hour ball games. Right now, nobody wants a three-hour ball game. They want it 2 hours and 30 minutes. Let's see if these rules get to it. I hate this week, very, very quietly, they confirmed that the runner on second base is going to be a permanent part of Major League Baseball rules in the 10th inning on.
It's consistent. It's consistent, though, because if you're going to make the game more digestible in terms of length, then this is consistent with that logic.
Yeah, I understand it's consistent, but it's just it's anti-everything that sports are about, meaning earning your way to a victory, earning your way 5 yards, 10 yards down the field, earning your way to a three-point shot, earning your way on base. There's no earning your way. It's just an automated way of playing a video game in the 10th inning on.
I'm sure people have reactions and opinions on the rules changes. 312-644-6767. What do you think? What do you like? What don't you like? And are you going to be more likely to go to a game if you think it might be shorter, it might be quicker, you might not have to wait, 45 seconds between pitches, you're going to have 15, and does the shot clock make you nervous? Or the pitch clock, because that's what Mully introduced this week. It's like, now he's got anxiety going to a Sox game, even more so than normal. But we'll see how it manifests itself. One thing, though, Bruce, in terms of the difference, the different rules as they apply, the banning the shift, I think it puts a premium on middle infielders and the athleticism that they're going to require to cover more ground. And we see that firsthand here in Chicago with the Cubs. They emphasize that when going to get Dansby Swanson and moving Nico Hoerner to second base. They essentially have two shortstops up the middle. So I asked Theo Epstein, who knows a little something about roster construction, how this might change the overall value of middle infielders.
There's going to be a premium on middle infield defense, especially the second baseman. I think that's the position that the profile changes the most because the most effective shifts were in the past were against left-handed hitters, and you could really hide, a third baseman playing, a third base profile at second base, knowing that when a lefty was up, you could put him in a position where he didn't have to range that much and give the shortstop the majority of the hard work. Well, now that second baseman's going to be naked. He's got to cover, along with the first baseman, cover the whole right side of the infield. You can't stick him deep into shallow right field. So range, athleticism, ability to make plays at the extremity of your range. So in other words, diving plays where you leave your feet, glove the ball and pop up quickly and throw the batter runner out. That's going to be extremely important. So I don't think teams are going to try to get away with a bat first, sort of corner profile at second base anymore. I think you're going to need more athletic second baseman. I think that's good for the game.
That was Theo Epstein, Bruce. Did the White Sox miss that memo?
Oh, wow. So you're not as high on Sosa as you were last year. Is that
no, you're right. I'm not as high on Lenin Sosa necessarily. That was for a spark, but you can definitely point to me. I did have the Lenin Sosa infatuation for a 2-week period in June, maybe a little bit longer. But Theo's point is well taken. Guys who are bat-first guys, maybe not the most athletic fielders, it might not be fits at second base. And I thought immediately, we talked about this on Friday, you feel bad for a guy like Jake Berger who had worked hard to get himself in a position to play second base, and you wonder if this is maybe the end of that kind of experimenting. You wonder where this is headed because of the premium placed on athleticism at those two middle infield spots.
The one area he didn't approach, which is really significant, is if there's a man on base and you have a left-handed hitter up, what do you do about that? Because now you've created even a bigger hole because the first baseman has to hold the runner on. Okay, so that is an even more significant part of it. Yeah, they've always done that, but now that was covered up because you had a third baseman or a shortstop in that hole along with the second baseman. I'm just wondering about outfield defense, David, and if the creativity goes to, well, you haven't told us that we can't shift our outfielders. So when you have an extreme pull hitter up, why not shift an outfielder over to a right center,
exactly,
right short center position?
So that's still within the rules. So let's say hypothetically, first time Cubs play the Phillies, Kyle Schwarber's at the plate, Ian Happ's in left field. Ian Happ's a pretty versatile guy. He used to play second base.
Yep.
Bring him in. Put him in short right. He doesn't have to be in the infield, but he's still going to be in a position where if there's a line drive hit the short right, he could still throw out Kyle Schwarber at first base. But if you're Kyle Schwarber and you see left field wide open, Bruce, doesn't that maybe entice you to try to maybe choke up, go the other way? I know it's easier said than done, but that's a higher risk.
It's more pressure in the pitcher catcher to make the right pitch. Okay?
Yeah, right.
So and what are you giving up here in that short run? What you're giving up is if it's a slow runner like Schwarber or a Rizzo, you're giving up an extra base if they do hit the ball the other way. You're making a double into a triple or a single into a double. In the case of a speed player, it could cost you, it could cost you a run from first base because of the fact that somebody is going to have to hightail out there, and by the time it gets in, you'll have a man on third base, and the other run will have scored. So there'll be people that will experiment with it. I guarantee you, and you'll see it in spring training.
That'll be fun to see how it all unfolds, and I do think people will get used to the pitch clock and the increased pace of the game. And I think in minor leagues, you talk to people who are in the booth at those games, maybe people who were just fans, they appreciated the fact that it was a little bit more of a rapid-paced game and there weren't as many lulls in the action. Maybe that'll result in a more entertaining brand of baseball, and people, of a certain age won't care. They'll be there anyway, but I think that you can't ignore the young audience and the way that baseball has to continue to try to appeal to them.
I agree. And look, I've been wrong before. I was the guy that when Bud Selig came up with the idea of interleague play, I didn't like it. Okay. I thought it was a bad idea. It turned out to be a great idea. It turned out to be something where the fans got to see all the players from all the teams eventually. And now they've taken it to another level where you're going to be guaranteed of seeing every team in your ballpark within a 2-year period, for sure, and that your team is going to play every team in baseball every year. So as much as I have to be pulled into some of these things, I have to keep an open mind that some of these things are going to work out to the advantage of the fan and the game.
Well, that was good for the game, and I think Theo Epstein being in charge of a baseball team is also good for baseball. And so before we let him go on Friday morning, had to ask him at this time of year, okay, you look out, it's late February, teams are reporting to spring training. How much does he maybe miss running a team, and could that be in his future? Theo, you did a great job explaining it, but admit it, you miss running a team a little bit, don't you?
Well, it's weird. This time of year, I wake up and I have that feeling like I'm forgetting something. I realize, like, my body thinks I'm supposed to be in spring training right now, meeting with players, figuring stuff out. So, yeah, this time of year, you know, the draft, the trade deadline, postseason, really do miss it. But I'm not even 50 yet, so I got some years ahead of me to get back in. I think this is I'm in the right role right now. I really appreciate the commissioner giving me the seat at the table for this important issue.
Bruce, that was great to hear from Theo. He sounded like somebody who took this role very seriously, and this is also part of his legacy, but as he reminded us quickly, not done yet. There's going to be another act, and I think anybody who doesn't think it's going to be a good one hasn't been paying attention. He's going to win again somewhere. I really just feel like it's just a matter of time.
I think he should be a hitting coach because he and Jed have had such a hard time finding the right hitting coach, you know, over these long periods of time. You know, they've done such wonderful things and built championship teams, but, you know, the hitting situation, I would love to see a guy like Theo come back as a hitting coach. He spent so much time with his big brain investigating it and figuring out what works and what doesn't. You know, come back. I'd like to see Theo in uniform. Let's see him in
I think he comes back as somebody who is the front person of whether it's call him baseball president, call him COO, CEO, whatever you want to call him. He's going to be a difference maker, an impactful leader. He'll have maybe part ownership of a group. And as Sean Sears points out, he could be the guy that saves the A's, whether they're in Oakland or Las Vegas or Portland or wherever they may be. He could be this guy that saves the A's, and you remember back to Moneyball. Can you imagine that collaboration? Billy Beane and Theo Epstein saved the Oakland/Portland/Vegas A's. I don't know where it's going to be, Bruce, but wherever he goes next, I don't think he's going to be restricted to being a hitting coach or in uniform. You're going to have this guy in jeans and a blazer, going to meetings, signing the right players, pushing the right buttons, and eventually celebrating another World Series.
Well, there's no doubt he's a Hall of Famer. He should go in. I don't see any reason why he shouldn't go in right now. He's not running a club right now. He's not employed by a team. So from that perspective, he's going into the Hall of Fame. The question is, when you've accomplished as much as he has, what do you do at age 50? You know, what do you do with yourself?
Do it again.
You want to run for Senate?
Do it again. No. Oh, my gosh, Bruce.
It's almost boring when you've taken franchises from 1908 and 1918 and won championships where it hadn't been won for, 88 years and 108 years. What kind of challenges would you have left in baseball if you're Theo Epstein?
You do it again. Success isn't boring. I think he finds ways to challenge himself in different environments with different kind of obstacles to clear. And he, as Sean points, he's addicted to the chase. Some guys are like that. And I respect him for that because he got away and he has never really overstayed his welcome. He knew exactly when to get out in Chicago in retrospect. People can be upset that he left and what he left behind in his wake, but he knew it was time and he did well in doing what he did when he did it. And so he's made an impact in this role as a consultant to Major League Baseball. He's biding his time for the right opportunity next. And Bruce, I don't think that will keep him away from getting back to baseball because that's a sport he's ideally suited for.
It might be a while. I mean, he's got three young kids that he's enjoying watching and driving to baseball and hockey and soccer practice right
now.
It's
a lot of traffic, Bruce. It's a lot of traffic.
So many cups of coffee, so many donuts you can eat waiting for them to finish their practices before you get a little antsy. But I think he's really enjoying the family element of it right now. And power to him that, as he said, he's not even 50 yet. He's accomplished everything in the world. He's a rich guy. And he has every opportunity in the world to get back into baseball whenever he wants to.
Well, I know our next guest will have thoughts on Theo Epstein and anything else you want to talk to him about. Paul Sullivan is the In the Wake of the News columnist for the Chicago Tribune, longtime baseball writer in this city. We will talk to him next. It's Inside the Clubhouse, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
We're back with more Inside the Clubhouse with Bruce Levine and David Haw.
The whole team's not here yet, so it's a wait and see thing. But if you needed last year to have a chip on your shoulder, then you got one. But I've had one my whole life, so.
Welcome back inside the clubhouse, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. David Haw, Bruce Levine, here until 11 o'clock. That was Lance Lynn on Friday. White Sox right-hander talking about having a chip on his shoulder his entire life. Great segue for our next guest who joins us on the Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas hotline, home of the world's largest sports book. Paul Sullivan is the In the Wake of the News columnist for the Chicago Tribune, good friend and former colleague. Hey, Sully, how are you doing this morning?
Great. How are you guys?
Doing well. And the chip on your shoulder is a good segue because you know all about that a little bit. But
because I have one?
Well,
you have a whole bag of chips.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Sully, I like to think of you as evenly balanced, a chip on both shoulders.
Yeah. Well, I'm at Camelback Ranch, and they won't let us. They've kicked us out of the stadium, so we have to work in the press box. They kicked us out of the complex. So, yeah, I have a chip on my shoulder. So we have to work about 20 minutes away from where the action is, so whatever.
Let's start with the White Sox, Sully. It's been a very newsy week at Camelback Ranch because of the Mike Clevenger situation. It hasn't reached its conclusion. We don't know where the investigation stands with Major League Baseball. The White Sox and Mike Clevenger have been very vehement in denying anything wrong in terms of his responsibility here. Said he will be fully exonerated. How would you describe the way they've handled it and where this is headed?
Well, honestly, I was surprised that they let him talk, but they wanted him to, and he wanted to, and he did talk the other day. But then once we started, really asking him some deeper questions, he just wanted to talk about baseball, and then it kind of made it like he was, not going to talk about it anymore. And then she came on your station and talked, and then they he talked again, I guess, yesterday to the Sun-Times, complaining about what she said. And I think it's just going to go on and on and on. And it's just very unfortunate for Sox fans because I don't think anyone really wants to hear about this. But it is a story, and until it ends, we're going to have to report on it.
You're in the position of general manager of the White Sox, not Rick Hahn. And you are looking back at this situation as to what you may have done beforehand, what you should do now. What does Paul Sullivan, the new general manager of the Chicago White Sox, look at when he looks at in the mirror and decides what he should have done and what he should do now?
Well, that's a very scary scenario right there, Chris. But I would say the first thing I would have done was not bring him to camp until this thing is resolved. The fact that they did, they're letting him talk, makes me believe that they do think it will be resolved and that he'll be exonerated. So if that's what they believe, and if they think that's the case, then I guess it makes sense for him to, get ready for spring, but or for the regular season. But I don't know. She gets very detailed descriptions of what happened, and it'd be very difficult to believe that she made all this up. So I don't know. If they expected her just to be quiet after he spoke, that's kind of ludicrous too. She's going to, I didn't know she'd go on your station, but I figured she'd be on Instagram talking about it. So I think they just opened a whole can of worms by bringing him here. They just should have hit him basically.
Right.
And then I've written before, maybe once it's over, try and cut the cord. But
probably,
I don't think that's happening.
It's probably a player association's problem.
Could be, yeah.
You know.
Well, Sully, we're joined by Paul Sullivan from the Chicago Tribune here and Inside the Clubhouse, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. So she comes forward and makes her claims publicly, much the way that back in, I think it was 2019, Addison Russell's accuser and ex-wife, Melissa Riddy, she went on WGN and, you know, amplified her accusations. This is part of the story. The question is, and beyond the he said, she said, Sully, I want to know what you think about two things. Number one, the White Sox were not privy to any of this specifically because they went into free agency without having, you know, they couldn't find out because of the confidentiality. Does there have to be some, at least, conversation about changing the process where there could be access to people who might be on a list of players being investigated? And secondly, in terms of, you know, the responsibility, if you want to call it that, of Mike Clevenger and his representation during these negotiations, wouldn't it come up, do they have an obligation to share that they are the subject of an investigation?
Well, Rick said that they didn't have the obligation to do that, and obviously they did not do that. And Rick said he understood why. I would imagine because he knew they wouldn't sign him. You know, $12 million, a lot of money. And when we asked him, I think it was Stephanie from SI asked him explicitly about it. He said that he thought it was over, which was ludicrous to think that, okay, yeah, they're going to investigate this, but then it's just going to drop it and no one's going to say anything about it. So that was kind of hard to believe that he thought that. And I don't believe that that was the case. As far as MLB changing the policy, that's kind of tricky because, you know, if you're innocent, and I'm not talking about this case, but in any case, if you are innocent and you're under investigation, you know, and you don't want other teams knowing about this because you shouldn't be judged because of something that didn't happen. So I don't know. It's just very strange, and maybe they should have said something to the White Sox. It's you know, Rick Hahn doesn't really care for me too much, but I do think that if he had known this, he wouldn't have signed him. I don't think he's that kind of a person. I think he's privately very upset about this, but, you know, there's nothing they can do now except for, in my estimation, cut the cord when this is all over.
The big
I don't think Sox fans are going to accept him. I don't know about you guys, but I just don't think, especially women and people that are very, you know, right thinking about domestic violence are not going to accept this guy pitching for them.
Well, the Cubs fans did accept Aroldis Chapman, if you remember correctly.
I do. And that was, but he didn't pitch there very long. As you recall, they didn't re-sign him. So,
there were 85 million reasons for that one, but it was probably not anything off the field. From your perspective,
almost blew the World Series too. I mean, that was one of them. I mean, if they had lost that, he would have been the new Bartman, don't you think?
Yeah, no doubt about that. Paul Sullivan joining us from Arizona on Inside the Clubhouse. David and Bruce every Saturday. 9 to 11 talking baseball with you 52 weeks out of the year. Sully, how about some baseball talk?
Yeah.
How do you look at the Chicago White Sox second base and right field situation? Where do they stand right now in your mind, and are these Achilles heels for them going into 2023?
Not necessarily. I mean, we don't know. If Colas is as good as he's been in the minors, I think that's not a bad thing for him to play at least part-time in right field. And I even understand that I know no one wants Eloy to be playing a lot in the outfield, but, you know, maybe once or twice a week. I don't think that would – hopefully wouldn't injure himself that way.
Yeah, as long as, they tell him, now when you're out there, don't – you can't get hurt, okay?
Yeah. But
I
don't mind some – situation where Colas is out in right field because he's supposed to be a very good prospect. As far as second, I think Romy's probably got the best shot there, and you know, he's had some good moments last year when they brought him up. You know, would I have liked to have seen the Sox assign someone or trade someone, a second baseman? For sure. But I don't think it's like a killer. You know, they still have a pretty good offense, even aside from those two guys, if everyone plays up to their capability.
Sully, so this week, as we do every year, we kind of hear the Pecota projections, and you look at the debate whether or not they were too low or too high. Pretty low expectations in Chicago for both teams. 78 wins for the White Sox, 77 for the Cubs. Would it surprise you if both teams are below 500 this season?
Yeah, it would, honestly. I think there's just too much talent on the Sox to have another season like that. Obviously, you know, this is a bad start just on the surface just because of all the controversy, but they still have some pretty good pitching, a really good bullpen, even if Liam's not there, and hopefully he'll be, you know, better and back at some point this season. But, you know, Kelly looked good in September. He said he's healthy. Graveman, I think, can close for him. Crochet is going to be back probably in, you know, mid, late April, early May. So, yeah, they've got a lot of talent. I think last year could be an anomaly. I think people forget the Astros, when they did the rebuild, they went backwards one year, and everyone thought, you know, that was the end of them, and they've been ever since then. So teams can have bad years. There was a lot of different reasons for that last year. I think the manager was part of it, not all of it, but definitely there's talent enough to compete. And the Cubs, you know, I think they could finish under 500, but, you know, we'll have to see about that. They've got so many players on comeback years that it's kind of hard to project them.
Sully, the first year since 2020 when David Ross took over as manager, that the Cubs are being looked at as a competitive team again. Will there be any pressure on David Ross to bring home a team that's over 500, that's in the mix all year, in the mix all season long?
Well, there will from us, for sure, from the media. I don't know about from Jed or that, although they, you know, everyone seems to go into the season saying they're going to contend, but he did get the extension last year. You know, this is his fourth season. And, you know, they just love him. So I don't see him being in any trouble, but yeah, they should contend, and there should be more pressure on him. We've really yet to see him with a contending type team. We did, I guess, in 2020 in the shortened season, but that was, you know, that was such a strange season, and they didn't even win a playoff game. So I'd like to put some pressure on him. We don't know what he can do yet, and he's certainly got some chances. So, you know, let's go.
So, Sully, controversy kind of makes it an obvious answer to the White Sox, what you know people are talking about this week. If you're going to Sloan Park, if you're going to Mesa, what, in your mind, is the most compelling storyline unfolding there? And if you had to, you know, devote a day to going to talk to some one person for an extended period of time, who would that be?
Well, I would say the two people who haven't spoken yet for the Cubs would be Bellinger, who hasn't, he's been around, but he's delayed his entrance. You know, he's going to be a very important part of this team. He was an MVP few years ago and then just completely lost it, you know, so he's got to change some of his mechanics, obviously. For the White Sox, it would be Tim Anderson, all-star, you know, face of the franchise, but had a poor defensive year last year and really not a very good second half, lost his power, got injured, didn't return, kind of disappeared in the offseason, and he hasn't spoken either yet, hopefully today or tomorrow. So it's a lot different from the old days. I don't know if you guys are coming down here, but you remember you used to come to spring training and there'd be like a bunch of guys in the clubhouse to, you just roam around, talk to whoever you want, Rizzo, Bryant, or but now they kind of like tell players, okay, you're talking today, and they kind of parcel it out over the first week, which is fine if you're a beat writer and you're going to be here all spring, but if you're here for TV or radio or you're only here for a few days, it's very difficult to get what you need.
Well, hopefully you will, and we'll be reading about it either way. Pick up a paper on Sunday. Go to ChicagoTribune.com. Paul Sullivan, in the wake of the news columnist, always worth your time. No plans
now?
Right now, Sully. No plans right
Bruce?
Now. But
it's a big on hold right now. So
wow, we need you. I'm the only old guy here.
To be there. I haven't missed the spring training since 1988. So from that perspective,
well, we miss you. Yeah, come on thanks. Down. Come on, Mitch. Get him down here.
Appreciate it. It's not on Mitch. It's personal.
Okay.
Thanks for your time, Sully.
Sorry.
Appreciate all that you brought to the table this morning. Keep it up, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Paul Sullivan from the Chicago Tribune. When we come back, we'll wrap things up here inside the clubhouse. Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
We're back with more Inside the Clubhouse with Bruce Levine and David Haw.
It's our ninth inning, closing things up. Bruce, I wanted to ask you about the topic we talked about last week at this time, hot one across Major League Baseball. This week, we got some news about the future of Diamond Sports, which owns 19 regional cable networks involving 14 Major League teams. They entered a 30-day grace period Wednesday with creditors after missing a scheduled interest payment of $140 million. That's about $1 billion at stake for Major League Baseball teams. Rob Manfred says, "We are prepared, no matter what happens, to make sure the games are available to fans in local markets. Our hope is that Diamond figures a way to pay us." So this is something that could affect how games, no matter how quickly they're played, are viewed by baseball fans across the country and markets everywhere.
Well, we talked about it last week at some length, David, and the reality is that within a few years, the cable industry will no longer be the number one place to get your sports, and in particular baseball. Major League Baseball is working on their own streaming system. They're holding teams off from doing their own streaming, which the Cubs were pretty on top of and ready to go with Marquee this year. And they're holding things off because Major League Baseball is trying to find a way to identify how to get these streamed and how to get them producing enough revenue to satisfy the clubs. So right now, Major League Baseball has guaranteed, as we said last week, that no fans are going to miss their games on television. But here is the problem. The problem is that there's no way for Major League Baseball, other than to get the production done for every game for these teams, to be able to identify how they're going to produce revenue for these games. Yeah, you can sell... Teams can sell their own advertising. That's fine. But, normally, unless you have places like the YES Network or the Dodgers or the Cubs with Marquee, it's not in-house. It's outside of the house. They pay a rights fee for this. Where is the money coming from to produce these games? Most of the teams getting anywhere from $60 to $150 million a year. In the case of the Dodgers, $300 million a year for their TV rights for the next 10 years. So from that perspective, where does this go? How does Major League Baseball identify a way to monetize this situation?
Quickly, Manfred also addressed how MLB is going to continue to try to resolve these blackout restrictions in markets throughout the country. Fans can't see the games they want to watch. And he said that the biggest priority, the number one priority, is reach and trying to find a way to balance everything there. But that's another issue in terms of it's a game everybody wants to see improved, Bruce, but everybody wants to see the games, and that's a big part of it.
Yeah, the one question I would have as a fan, and I am one, is how did we get to this place so quickly without a solution coming up here? How did we see the crash of the cable market, the influx of streaming, and Major League Baseball and other sports not necessarily prepared for this all happening at once?
That's a good question. There's going to be a lot more coming up this week, and we're going to be there all week long on the Mully and Haas show, throughout the day on the Score. The Cubs are in Mesa at Sloan Park, and the White Sox certainly at Camelback Ranch. Plenty to talk about at White Sox spring training. Bruce, thank you for lining up the guests today. Thank you for all your contributions. It was a very interesting show.
It was a great show. We thank Paul Sullivan for joining us from the Tribune. Also, Jan Gomes from the Chicago Cubs. People can follow me on Twitter, MLB Bruce Levine. Also on our website, 670thescore.com. Great job by Sean Sears, our great producer. David, have a wonderful week. Thanks so much for being a great co-host every single Saturday.
Thank you, Bruce, and thank you, everyone, for listening, calling, texting, and contributing. You've been listening to Inside the Clubhouse right here on Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.